Welcome to Moolala, Money Made Simple on SiriusXM. Here's your host, Bruce Sellery.
Hello, I'm Bruce Sellery. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. Make America Great Again isn't just a political slogan. It's now the name of an exchange-traded fund designed to track the fortunes of stocks that may benefit from the Trump presidency. We'll talk to its creator. Then we have become a culture addicted to credit cards. So if you're going to rely on them, as we all seem to do these days, you should probably spend some time finding the one that's right for you. The founder of Credit Card Genius, an online card comparison engine, will be our guest. And insight into the implications of the Liberal government's tax reform plan, Dave Walsh will be here with his point of view. He's with BDO Canada. Plus, real estate expert Limor Markman on how first-time home buyers can avoid common real estate mistakes. Let's get started. Betting on Trump. We're not talking about the slots at a Trump casino. We're talking about the stock market. There's a new exchange-traded fund designed to track companies that stand to benefit from the Trump presidency. The ticker is MAGA, MAGA, which stands for Make America Great Again. It was created by Hal Lambert, the founder of Point Bridge Capital. He joins us now from Fort Worth, Texas. Hello there.
Hello, how are you?
You are a Republican. You've raised money for the party in the past. Where did the idea for an ETF come from?
Well, I guess a couple of things. We realize that many people desire a certain political outcome, but don't necessarily have the funds or want to spend the additional funds to contribute to political races. So many would rather invest in American markets to save for retirement and seek personal financial security. But, because some of the conservative ideology is, and the Republican Party is free markets, restraint of spending, that kind of thing, I think MAGA makes perfect sense for people. They can now invest in the markets and help achieve a political outcome.
Is this a spin on socially responsible investing? You know, people who pursue ETFs or mutual funds that exclude certain categories like, you know, oil and gas or alcohol or something. Is this sort of in that broad vein?
I guess you could say that. I'm calling this actually politically responsible investing. So, I guess you would say that there's a little bit similarity to that. And I think from this perspective of what people are trying to accomplish, it works well.
Tell me about your methodology here. How did you approach choosing the companies that would go into it?
Sure. So what I did was I took the S&P 500 and I screened the S&P 500 for the political contributions of the PACs, the political action committees, and the employees of each of the companies. And that data is reported to the Federal Election Commission here in the U.S., and that data is out there. So I screened the data and looked at the net contributions of those entities to Republicans versus Democrats, and then using a rules-based methodology, looked at and created a top 150 stocks within the index that are Republican-supporting.
And why did you choose that methodology? And I ask because some of those companies and some of those individuals may be making those donations to hedge their bets. They may have donated the equal amount to the other side. You don't have a way of knowing that, do you?
Sure. Yeah. No, in fact, we looked at that. And no, these are companies that are heavily supporting Republicans over Democrats. So that they may companies may give to both sides. But one side, they're giving a lot more to one side versus the other.
So you say politically responsible. Any idea what the expectation is for how the stocks inside this ETF will perform? I mean, I know that you cannot predict future returns, but did you backtest the portfolio?
We did backtest it, and we were not allowed from a regulatory standpoint to market backtested performance. But I feel very comfortable about what I saw, and I feel very comfortable about the stocks that are in the portfolio. You've got quite a few things like defense stocks, a lot of financials, energy stocks, you know, different industrials like Caterpillar, and it's a great basket of securities. And again, being 150 of the S&P 500, you know, the S&P 500 is a great index, so. When you start with that, you're going to start with some pretty solid companies to begin with.
So some of the stories that made headlines here, both in the campaign and afterwards, were things like the wall in the South. Are there construction companies or infrastructure companies in there?
Sure. I mean, Caterpillar being obviously an infrastructure play. You look at you look at companies from the standpoint of the diversification of the portfolio. You know, it's about 22% industrials right now. So there's a lot of industrials in it. It's about 20% financials. So those are the two largest sectors within the index, and very little. So this is not for people that want to have a bunch of technology stocks, because as most people know, the technology companies in Silicon Valley are heavily Democrat supporting. And so those companies are not in the portfolio based on their Democratic contribution.
I was going to ask you about that. Does that then make it a value fund versus a growth fund? I mean, when you look at that makeup and apply that particular lens to it, would that characterize, sort of the investing style?
You know, it's a good question. I would say that people would probably certainly look at it more from that perspective than they would the perspective of a growth portfolio. From growth stocks, although I would say a lot of these stocks, have done very well. The dividend yield in the portfolio is right around 2.4%. So it's got a great dividend yield versus the S&P 500 has a lower dividend yield than that. It's got companies like Home Depot in it. Home Depot is obviously a construction, or at least indirectly a construction company, because that's where a lot of construction companies buy their products.
Yeah. Yeah, and a huge company for all the natural disasters that the southern U.S. and Central America have been dealing with hurricanes and such, right?
Sure.
Now, how risky a strategy is this, do you think, investing in companies with political beliefs that are similar to yours?
Well, I'd put this in the category of, obviously, it's obviously a stock or equity allocation. So people should certainly think of it from that perspective that, if they're going to have an allocation to equities, I feel comfortable about the position of this. I mean, you've got 150 stocks, and they're equally weighted. So you're not going to have a massive amount in any one given stock, one particular stock. So it should be able to hold up well with if there's one particular stock that does poorly. And from the perspective of the types of companies that are in here, I would put it in a category of I certainly would categorize this as kind of a core equity holding with the way it's positioned.
What has been your report card so far on the Trump presidency as it relates to the companies that are in this fund? So has he been moving the needle on things like financial regulation and infrastructure investment?
Yeah, I'd say for definitely been moving the needle on financial deregulation because there's been a lot of deregulation that he's been able to do on his own through executive action. And so I think the regulatory environment has been getting better, every month. And that's beneficial to all companies. So I think I think that's one of the reasons you're continuing to see the market as a whole move up is the regulatory environment is expected to get better. And then obviously we're looking at, the tax cuts and whether or not, the tax cuts are going to make it through in the next month or so. And then there's, of course, the healthcare debate that we had, but I think that's actually coming back up again. They're trying to get something else through potentially this month in Washington. All those things I think are beneficial if any of them can happen, at least the other two. I think the regulatory has already begun to happen, but from the standpoint of the healthcare and the taxes, I think either one of those would be very, very helpful overall.
With any investing story, there is always steak and sizzle, and it's sort of a combo of these two things. It would seem from up here north of the border that there is a lot of sizzle. There's a lot of talk. There's a lot of stories, but relatively little legislative progress. Is that an accurate characterization?
I'd say the big legislative, thing that they tackled in the first part of this year was healthcare. And obviously they didn't make it through on that. I think they're going to revisit it. But I think there's a lot of things that can be done, again, just from the executive, the White House, from a regulatory standpoint, that's very, very helpful, whether it be on oil and gas regulations as well as, financial regulations and other industries as well. So I think there's a lot of things going on, that aren't really talked about much in the media. But the next big one, of course, is going to be taxes. And I think we'll get something done on that. And I think that's going to be good for stocks in the U.S., and I think it'll probably be good for stocks globally.
How would you describe your conservatism? Would you say you're a fiscal conservative, a social conservative, or both?
I'd probably put myself in the category of both.
And how does the social conservatism manifest itself in the portfolio? I mean, it's easy to make a bet, easier to make a bet on, you know, financial deregulation, good for banks, thumbs up. But what about on the social conservatism front?
Well, you know, really it is, it's driven by the political contributions of the companies. So obviously I don't have any say in what they're doing. They're making those decisions. We're using rules, a rules-based methodology. So, you know, if a company changes from one political, you know, contribution in one cycle to another, then they either could be added or taken out of the portfolio. So I wouldn't put this in the category of some sort of a values-based portfolio. It's not driven by that. There are, there are some types of strategies out there. There are, no tobacco or no firearms or no oil and gas. So there's different types of values type investing out there. This is purely, politically driven, and policy, I think, then comes from what happens politically. So
yeah, I would argue that they're inextricably linked. I mean, someone who has a value for low taxes would that's a different value from someone who values the social safety net, if we were to magnify the difference on the spectrum.
Oh, I see. Well, you're saying that I see what you're saying. You're saying that values of one side versus values of the other side. You know, again, that's going to be driven by the values of the parties themselves, right? And so the political values within the Republican Party are going to be different than the political values of the Democrat Party in the U.S.
There are those who are not so enthusiastic. I don't need to tell you this. There are those who are not so enthusiastic about the Trump presidency so far. How do you feel about them shorting the ETF?
Hey, they can go right ahead and do it. The ETF is... It's highly liquid because the securities in it are very liquid. So, if that's what people choose to do, then they could certainly choose to do that.
There are a lot of ETFs on the market right now. What asset level do you need to hit for this to be viable?
It's already, I think, viable from that perspective. But I would say, I think this has the ability to have quite a bit of assets in it. We're just now starting the fund just launched September 7th, and it's already trading up nicely. Right now I'm looking at my screen. It's at $25.62. It came out at 25. And so I think from the perspective of going forward, I'd love to see the assets continue to grow and grow. And I think there's a lot of room for this out there because there isn't another investment strategy like this in the market.
Very interesting. Hal, thanks for your time today. We appreciate it.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much.
Hal Lambert is the founder of PointBridge Capital, the company behind MAGA, which stands for Make America Great Again, an exchange-traded fund focused on the prospects for Trump's presidency. Stay with us. Coming up later on the program, the Liberal government here in Canada is pushing ahead with tax changes aimed at private corporations. What does it really mean for small business? But next, I hate all the crap I get sent on credit cards. Is there someone else who could assess all that for me? We'll talk to the founder of one of the credit card websites to learn about the method behind the madness. Follow me at Bruce Selry on Twitter, Bruce Selry on Facebook. We'll be right back.
Listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
I'm Bruce Ellery. This is Moolah La, Money Made Simple. Remember cash? It's quaint to think back to the days when you raced to the bank before the Friday closing so you'd have some paper to spend on the weekend. Credit cards, of course, are now ubiquitous and almost a necessity. But how do you choose the right one? Stephen Wayman is the founder of Credit Card Genius, a card comparison site. He joins us now from Moncton, New Brunswick. Hello there.
Hey, how are you?
How does Credit Card Genius work?
Well, the way Credit Card Genius works is that we take a look at what's most important to an individual person what their needs are when it comes to a credit card. And we created a slider system so that you can quickly make three choices and choose what's most important to you. And then after you do that, you do what we call a genius search, and that brings you to a comparison page where you see the top credit card recommendations for you based on what's important to you. And how that works is that we have a scoring system or a genius rating system that takes over 50 factors of every credit card on the market in Canada into consideration and combines that with your preferences to give you a custom score for every credit card in Canada, and it shows you which ones are best for you.
How do you determine what is best for you? And I ask because one of the sliders is cash back or rewards. I don't know. I've just kind of always had a rewards card. Should I have a cash back one instead?
Well, you know, it's pretty personal how you determine what's best for you, but we took a more data-centric approach to it. We reached out to a bunch of our subscribers by email and had them complete a survey about what challenges are most important to them when choosing a credit card. And we were able to distill all those answers that they gave us into some big categories of the most important things. And that's how we came up with the categories on our sliders. Now, in terms of cashback versus travel, it really just comes down to how flexible you want your rewards to be. If you don't want any hassle or any hoops to jump through, then you make the choice for cash. If you are willing to do a little more extra work to figure out the reward system and to maximize your rewards, then you're probably going to get more rewards for your spending with a travel or rewards card. But there's a little bit of extra work.
Any idea what the premium is? Like, is it 5%, 10%, 20%?
Well, cashback credit cards typically will net you in the 1.5 to 2% range, depending on your spending and the card that you get. With a true rewards card, especially something that gives you airline miles, you can, on the average, eke out between 2.5 to 3%. And then if you're really fancy and you only focus on the most premium destinations and flying in first or business class, you can get up to, a 6, 7, sometimes even 10% return on your spending.
A lot of Canadians carry a balance on their credit card every month, like a lot. What should they be looking for when it comes to finding a credit card?
Well, if you're carrying a balance on your credit card, I mean, my recommendation is always to try not to do that, because there are a lot of cheaper ways to borrow money than borrowing through, especially a traditional credit card. So I'd say plan A would be to investigate those different options.
Yeah, but I need a plan B, because the plan A on losing weight is don't eat carbs. That's not working so much for me.
Well, plan B could be looking at one of those different options, because
salad.
If you have never done that before.
I like salad.
That is your plan B. So, I'd look at home equity lines of credit, regular lines of credit, even a loan from friends and family if you aren't worried about damaging the relationship. If those things don't work, then you can also look at a low interest credit card. And there are quite a few good options out there, but it does depend on your credit score being pretty good. So if you haven't been paying on time and you've always been late, then your options are much more limited. But if you have a half decent credit score, you can qualify for rates as low as 5% on some variable rate credit cards, but 10% is more the norm. Now, a regular credit card interest rate is, 20 to 22%. So you're saving quite a bit even with 10%. And then another option is balance transfer credit cards that give you up to 0% interest rates for a promotional period, which is usually up to a year. So you can be saving your entire interest for a year if you put together a plan to pay that off. Even if you pay it off at the end with another credit card or another loan, you can save that full interest cost over a period of a year.
Now, what are the pros and cons on these 0% interest cards? I'm a full-on pay off the credit card come hell or high water every single month kind of person, but a lot of people aren't and can't be. What should they know before they, get all entranced by that 0% card?
Yeah, if you're interested in a 0% card, number one rule is only use that card for your promotional balance transfer rate. Don't ever make a regular purchase on it ever, at least not until your balance is paid in full, because what happens is you'll end up paying the normal interest rate on those purchases until your entire promotional balance is paid off. So don't ever use it for anything else. Number two is, you need a plan to pay it off when the promotion ends, because then your rate is going to jump up to the sky high 21.99%. Third, you need to pay your minimum balance every month on time, because if you don't pay on time every month, it's only going to be a few dollars. But if you don't pay it on time, then they'll give you a penalty rate and they'll probably bring your rate back up to the normal rate. So you need to pay on time every month that little bit of interest, just to keep your promotional rate in check. And be aware that there's usually a fee for doing the initial balance transfer. On the top 0% card, it's only 1%. So, you know, paying 1% over the period of an entire year is no big deal, but that fee does exist.
There are new credit cards on offer all the time, or at least it seems to me going through my mail that there are new cards on offer all the time. What are you seeing in terms of real innovation here? Not just, you know, a new this or a new that, but what are some of the big things that are happening that could move this sector forward?
Yeah, well, in terms of innovation, I mean, I think most of it's pretty standard, to be honest. You know, it's just a difference in rewards. Sometimes there's a few added perks here or there. It's really just a matter of finding the one that combines everything in the best possible way for you. But the most innovative thing I think I've seen recently in terms of rewards was the Tangerine Moneyback credit card, which allows you to choose categories where you spend the most of your money and you get increased rewards on those categories. So their normal rate of return is 0.5%, but in three categories that you get to choose, and you can change them every 3 months, that goes up to 2%. So you're getting quadruple the rewards on the stuff you buy most of. So that was a bit of an innovation here in Canada. The second thing I think that's happening, you know, as you mentioned in the intro, that we're going towards a cashless society, and the big credit card networks like Visa, MasterCard, and American Express, they're really pushing this because it's good for them. And, you know, it is convenient also for the merchants. It's much easier to track their revenue, and there's the rewards for the consumers. But I think the big push there is with the smartphone, Apple Pay, you know, iOS Pay or Android Pay, that allow you to integrate your credit card right with your smartphone. So you can leave it at home and you can pay at the checkout just by tapping your phone. But ultimately, I think that we're never really going to get rid of cash in our society because it's a fail-proof backup that always works even when technology fails. And my thinking is that we're never going to be in a place where the technology is so fail-proof that cash won't be necessary. So, you know, I think we're going to move towards cashless, but I doubt whether we're going to actually fully get there.
Yeah. You got to pay the babysitters with cash. They don't take Square currently, at least. I haven't seen
it. Not yet. They're too young for that.
How often can you switch credit cards without taking a hit to your credit score? Because one of the variables on credit score that people don't often know about is duration of credit history. And I get concerned when people are all enamored with these new card launches, bopping around and maybe taking a hit.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, credit age of your credit does factor a lot into your credit score. So I always say, keep one of your older credit cards, particularly a no-fee credit card. And if it is a fee one, ask the bank if you can downgrade to a no-fee one. And just keep that card, you know, active, put like one purchase on it a year or a small recurring purchase like your Netflix subscription that comes on that card every year to keep it active. And that will sort of lengthen out the average age of your accounts and strengthen your credit score. In terms of my rule of thumb is, you know, I try to apply for one or two credit cards a year. That's not going to have a big negative impact on your credit score. You know, you're going to benefit from sign-up bonuses and increased rewards. And if there's something new that comes out, you know, you can try it out. There's no risk in doing that. You know, there are people who do dozens a year, and they have strategies for doing that. But for the regular everyday person, you know, one to two is pretty much a safe bet.
You have a best cards list. Two of them are from American Express, which surprised me here because there seems to be the sense that they aren't nearly as widely accepted as MasterCard and Visa. Did that count against them in the algorithm?
Absolutely, yes, it does count against them in the algorithm. I have thought about increasing the weight of that penalty in the algorithm, and you know, I have increased it a little bit. But the thing is that American Express cards just tend to offer so much extra rewards, perks, and features compared to the competition that they just overpower that negative factor. So if you like the looks of American Express card, what I always say is couple a premium or good American Express card with a backup no fee either cash back or rewards credit card. And if the store you're shopping at doesn't take Amex, just whip out the other one and pay with that.
Briefly before we go, aside from inertia, what is the single most common pitfall or error people make when it comes to credit cards?
Well, I mean, you know, I have to go with the tried and true, not paying your balance in full every month. I mean, using it as sort of like an ATM when they're running out of cash. I think that, you know, you need to be getting your credit in order and getting your loans ready when you don't need them. So, you know, you should have a line of credit ready for those times, or overdraft protection, or a home equity line of credit, or some other means of borrowing money other than your credit card. And an emergency fund, of course, too, is obviously a good idea. So that's the biggest mistake that people make, is they just use it when the unexpected happens.
Yeah.
And probably shouldn't.
Stephen, thanks for your time today. We appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you very much, Bruce.
Stephen Wayman is the founder of Credit Card Genius, a card comparison site. Stay with us. Coming up later, the Moolah La Questionnaire. But first, common mistakes first-time home buyers make and how to avoid them. Lamour Markman will be our guest. You can check out my first book, Moolah La, Why Smart People Do Dumb Things With Their Money and What You Can Do About It. Credit cards, one theme there. Order it online. Or at a local bookstore. We love our local bookstores. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
I'm Bruce Ellery. This is Moolah La, Money Made Simple. Real estate continues to be a very hot topic in lunchrooms and playgrounds across Canada. Interest rates are heading higher, and regulatory changes appear to be having an effect. So what are buyers to do? Lamour Markman is a real estate expert. She's here to talk about mistakes first-time home buyers make and how to avoid them. Hello there.
Hi, thanks for having me.
We are a national program. There is so much regional nuance to real estate. How do you think about providing advice to the first-time home buyer that differs according to the dynamics of the market?
Yeah, well, there's definitely a lot of generic advice, and I know we're going to get into those a little bit later as we chat through today. But I think as first-time home buyers, depending on what market you're in, you need to know if you're going to be in a super quick, hot market. You're going to have to know everything up front in advance. You're not going to have time to review the offer in advance. You're not going to have time to have a lot of back and forth in conditions. So if you're in a super hot market, you want to make sure you're doing a little bit more of your due diligence up front. That may mean spending an extra couple $100, maybe have an inspection before you put in the offer, but you do not want to end up with a property that has got some serious defaults in it just because, and you didn't know that because the market was so hot.
One of the mistakes you flag is on an appraisal condition. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, so we've been hearing a lot in the news lately, the last month with chaos, where buyers need to actually pull out of the offer after they put in the offer because they don't have enough money to close. So they had a pre-approval before they put the offer in, thinking, oh, great, I've got my financing.
Yeah, I am easy breezy.
Good to go. My realtor said I'm pre-approved. I'm good to go. But in reality, your lender won't give you the money until the property itself has been approved as well.
And the difference being that they pay $1.2 million for the house, but the lender says, I don't know if it's worth
that. The value has come down. Yeah. So if you thought it was 1.2, that's what you put your offer in. But the lender's like, hold on, it's 1.1. They're only going to give you 80% of the 1.1. So buyers are scrambling. So the easy way to avoid this is make sure that you put in a financing condition and you don't actually lift it until the appraisal is done from the lender.
A lot of first-time buyers are getting help from the bank of mom and dad. It's why I think one of the big reasons why we can see, you know, 26-year-olds buying a $700,000 condo. You recommend that the money they're gifted or loaned goes into an RRSP first. Is this the first-time home buyers program you're talking about?
Yeah, so this is the first-time home buyers plan, because a lot of time when we get, you know, gifts from mom and dad, we don't necessarily think about putting
A fuzzy sweater. I don't get the down payment on a house.
Well, listen, maybe when you were 26, you should have negotiated a little bit better.
They wouldn't have done that for me.
Yeah, but I think a lot of times people who aren't necessarily focusing on putting money in their RRSP for the first-time home buyers plan, then they get this gift. You know, they're going to buy in 6 months. They don't necessarily think to put the money in their RRSP first. And if they put it in there, you know, leave it in there for the 90 days, which is required, they can get a hefty refund, or they can use that credit for future years. And you know, when you are cash strapped buying your first house, you know, even if it's a few thousand dollars, it's going to go a long way.
And when it's in your RRSP, please tell me you don't recommend they trade penny stocks while it's in there.
No, if you
it's
need
parked.
To, it's parked. But you know, if your parents are giving it to you just a few months before you're buying it, probably better to leave it in something very liquid because you're going to be taking it out within a few months.
Now, with the home buyer's plan, they have to pay back the money, and
you
that
do.
Starts very quickly.
Yes.
You've got 15 years to do it. How do you make sure you build that into cash flow? Because a lot of people are house poor from the day they move in.
Yeah. So, I mean, there is an opportunity for the 15 years to start. I believe it's 1 or 2 years after you've purchased your first home. So you do have a little bit of space there. But it's something that you need to be aware of. It's in your notice of assessment. I know we don't all look at that. But, you know, you do have to pay 1/15th every year for the 15 years until it's all paid back.
One of your other mistakes is people giving their deposit to the realtor. You say, give it to your lawyer. How come?
So this is something that's actually very commonplace in the investing world, which is kind of how I got to learn about it, doing investing in multiple provinces across Canada. Because if you give your deposit to the seller's realtor, the seller's brokerage, which is really common because that's what the seller will often request, if you decide before you've taken your conditions off that there's something wrong with the property, your financing doesn't come through, I don't know, something happened with the home inspection, sometimes it can take a long time to get your money back. Whereas if you've got your money with your own lawyer, you can get it back pretty quickly. And sometimes that can stop you from getting into the market if it takes a few weeks before the sellers give the money back.
In a competitive market like Toronto and Vancouver, I just worry that wouldn't work. When we bought our house 2 years ago, not only did we give the deposit check to the realtor, we had like photos of our gorgeous child. I would have, if someone said, I like your watch, I would have said, take my watch. Have my
too.
Watch. What
yeah.
else do you need? A lock of my hair?
Yeah, well, I mean, exactly what you're saying. I mean, it's a national program and it never hurts to ask. You never actually know, you know, if you're helping by putting in a higher purchase price or if you're helping the seller by closing quickly, you know, they are in fact going to get the money. So it depends on all of the terms and how they fit together, but it doesn't hurt to ask.
Adjusting ownership ratios for parents. What do you mean by that?
So a lot of first-time homebuyers, not only do we get some money from mom and dad, but sometimes for a $700,000 or $800,000 mortgage, we need their help qualifying for the mortgage. And when mom or dad are on the mortgage, you want to have a chat with your lawyer up front to let them know that mom and dad actually aren't going to be living in the property because...
Provided they aren't. Maybe they are. Maybe that's secretly what they really want.
Maybe it's what they want, but hopefully that's not what's going to happen. That's you're probably already living in their house. You know, you don't need
in their basement. You don't want them in your main floor.
There you go. So in the instance where a parent helps you qualify for a mortgage, you just want to make sure that they're not on title 50-50 because you don't have to pay capital gains when you sell your own house, but your parents not living in your house could have some dire tax implications in the future. So you can adjust the ownership where you are 99% and your parents are 1%.
Home inspections are not a thing in a competitive situation, but in a market where they are, you know, relevant and you have time to get them.
Yeah.
How do you use them? How do you use them best?
Well, one of the things that I really recommend, especially first-time home buyers do, and again, this is typical in the investing community, is I'm going to have a home inspection after my offer is accepted, and I'm going to get a home inspector who is willing to generate quotes for me, which will both identify when an item or part of the house is going to be needing repairs, as well as how much it's going to cost. So if I've got written documentation from this morning saying, you know, the roof needs to be repaired in 6 months and it's going to cost me $20,000, I've got proof to go back to the seller and say, hey, this is the situation. Do you mind to either decrease the purchase price or repair it yourself? And at the very least, if you can't get any of those concessions, you know that it's going to be a $20,000 bill for you. And so you're not surprised if that comes down the pipe.
One of the big mistakes that I see people make is people buying too much house. This was not on your top three list of mistakes people make. How come?
Well, I think that's probably the mistake that most people talk about. So I was trying to get into the ones that are a little bit more unconventional. Yeah, you do not want to end up in a situation where you are house rich and cash poor. Your life's really going to be challenging at that point in time, especially if you're millennial, you're buying your first home, you're used to going out for fancy dinners or restaurants or vacations. And so, you know, it's definitely something to be aware of. But it wasn't in my top few because it's what everybody
right.
talks
oh,
about.
Oh, are you calling me a cliche?
No.
I'm clearly, but I, here's where I think, I'm just kidding. Here's where I think it's relevant is young people in particular have never seen rates anywhere above 5%, let alone at 8, 10, 18%, like the 80s. You're way too young to know that.
They were freaking out when we had, you know, the tiny bumps
this summer. A teeny tiny
one. Yeah.
So as they think about the cash flow that they're doing, and they would probably do this with a mortgage broker, mortgage professional, what's the sensitivity that you think they should be factoring in, given that this is going to be something that's amortized over a couple of decades? Is it 5%? Is it 6%? Because it sure ain't 3%.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's good to look at a 5%. But the other thing to take into consideration, well, hopefully if you are in your late 20s, early 30s, you're on the up ramp on your career. So hopefully in 5 years' time, if you've got a five-year fixed mortgage, not only is your mortgage going to go up, but hopefully you've got a little bit of income there increased as well to try to alleviate that. But absolutely, being completely strapped, having every last dollar going towards your mortgage could put you in a really tough situation. And that's actually why I've been putting all of these great tips together for first-time homebuyers in a course. Because first-time homebuyers have no idea what to do, and it's not their fault. None of them have been taught in school. And so, you know, as an investor, particularly in the GTA market, when things started slowing down in the spring or kind of going into chaos, I had so many first-time homebuyers reaching out and asking a lot of questions about the process.
What has informed your view and what has provided you with experience in the real estate world?
So I've been investing in real estate for about 4.5 years now. I've got investments in Ontario, Manitoba, and Alberta. Actually, I've been teaching real estate investing seminars for 2.5 years. So I've done a lot of research on the nuances. And, you know, I work with a lot of my students to review all of their deals, all of the elements of their deals to see what, in fact, could potentially go wrong. Got great mentors in the industry. So, you know, have definitely reviewed well over 300 real estate deals across Canada at this point.
And the website for your course that you're launching soon
is homepurchasingsecrets.com. So the course is called Home Purchasing Secrets, and the course can be found at homepurchasingsecrets.com.
Interesting. Well, Lamora, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
We appreciate it. Lamora Merkman is a real estate expert, and we've got much more ahead. Stay with us. Coming up next, tax changes proposed by the Liberal government will lead to a big rethink for small business people, in particular when it comes to their estate plan. Dave Walsh is tax service line leader at BDO Canada. He'll be here. And we'll take you through the Moolala questionnaire. You can subscribe to the podcast version of this show. It's on iTunes. Check it out. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
The Liberal government is pushing a plan to change the tax treatment for private corporations. There are a great many implications for small business owners, including how they build their estate plan. Dave Walsh is tax service line leader for BDO Canada in Ottawa, Ontario. He joins us now. Hello there, Dave.
Hi, Bruce. How are you?
I am well. The consultation period for the reforms is continuing, but give us the top line here. Let's start with a brief summary of what's on the table.
Yeah, the consultation period, Bruce, is going to run until October the 2nd, which is the end of the 75-day period the government announced when these proposals were released in the middle of the summer and vacation season for Canadians. So that's coming to a close. People have a couple more weeks to get their submissions in, and then there'll be a period after that that the government reviews all submissions and then hopefully releases what we would like to see and would be revised proposals after that.
Now, for people who currently use a corporation in this way, maybe they're a doctor, maybe they're who knows what they do for a living, consultant, whatever it is, they run a small business of some sort. How do they typically set up their trust and estate plan? How do they do it currently?
Well, normally they would have members of their family, whether it be spouses or children, be beneficiaries of a trust. And that trust could then own shares of the family business, the private business. And then the income of the business gets distributed to the trust and shared amongst those beneficiaries. So on a year-to-year basis, each of the family members could be participating in the income of the business by way of it being distributed through the trust.
And
that
would
be a common scenario.
If things went through as proposed, and there's a great deal of uncertainty as to what actually is going to get executed, but if they did, what would be the changes? How would that affect how they do their trust and estate plan?
The significant changes to the taxation of that income going to the family members out of the trust, whereas now They can participate in that income and pay tax at their marginal rate. So if you have lower income earners, the tax would be low. In this case, now they're going to, the proposals would force that income to be taxed at the highest marginal rate, regardless of what other income the person had. So effectively, there are current rules in place for minor children. They're called the kiddie tax rules. That's how those rules work currently. What it would be effectively doing is taking those rules and applying it to all family members regardless of how old they are, so including adult children. So it would be a significant increase in the tax burden for the family unit if they have it structured this way.
What are some changes that you slash your firm slash your clients would like to see made?
Well, first and foremost, a longer consultation period. We feel that the government, you know, releasing it in the summer, people haven't been able to absorb the rules with the diligence that they should. So we'd like to see a longer consultation period. We would certainly like to see the rules are very complex, Bruce, and they're making the Income Tax Act even more complex. And for everyday private business owners, they're putting a big burden on them. So we would like to see the rules simplified. And if they need to increase the tax base of Canadians, they could do it in a much more simple fashion. And they're certainly going after professionals as well. There's a number of doctors and lawyers and accountants and other professionals that are incorporated. They benefit from the rules that have been in place for over 40 years. And again, they're catching a lot of people by surprise, and they're not giving them much time to plan into new structures.
So as it relates to the trust and the estate plan, if this goes through, and we've got 12,000 ifs here, so I know I'm asking you a tough question, what would be the path for people here? Would they wind down the corp? Would they... What are some options?
Well, there is a lot of uncertainty, as you alluded to. So with the consultation period ending at the end of October 2nd, we're not going to know what the new rules are for months, 2 months, 3 months. We don't know when they're going to be enacted. So there is a little bit of uncertainty here that people have to be cautious in terms of, I wouldn't want to see people jumping into a new structure right away because we don't know how this is going to unfold. But the key message is the rules as they're currently enacted are still in effect until the end of the year. So if you're splitting income with family members, you're still able to do that in 2017. The proposed rules, even if they go ahead as planned, would not take effect until 2018. So what I would advise them to do is maximize to the extent possible the income splitting rules that are at their disposal for this year. And then getting into 2018, look ahead then and, you know, get into a new structure at that point in time. But our advice to our clients is use these rules as they're currently enacted to the best of their ability in 2017.
Of the things that are going on here, income sprinkling, passive income changes, and capital gains, it seems easiest to turn off the taps on income sprinkling, like just don't do that anymore. But with passive income, given, as you say, this has been around for a fairly long time and people have built up significant assets, many of them in the corporation, and that's how they view their retirement savings plan, how would they go about altering how that income is withdrawn and what tax they paid on it?
Well, yeah, great question, because the other interesting problem we have there, Bruce, is we don't have draft legislation yet for that piece of it, for the passive income. They've only indicated what they view to be a problem and what they might want to do to fix it, but they actually didn't release draft legislation. So there's a lot of speculation as to what it might look like, and there's no doubt that the taxation on the income held inside a corporation that would be passive in nature would go up significantly. If they enact it the way that they're saying they would. But again, I wouldn't want to advise people to go ahead and do something drastic right now to fix a problem when we don't know exactly what it's going to look like going forward. But to your point, this is something that a lot of professionals and business owners use where they've been building up. These are people that typically don't have a pension plan. So they've just built up excess cash inside their corporation and invested it that way for their retirement and for their family's retirement. So I wouldn't want to see people rush into something until we see more clarity on what finance is proposing. And again, they still need to release draft legislation on what they are proposing. So I would encourage people to be patient. This consultation period, I would say, has attracted more media attention than any other proposed tax changes that I've seen in my career. And I am optimistic that finance will listen to Canadians and make some changes. And I would advise people to to wait until we see some proposed legislation on the passive income before making any drastic changes.
A portion of our listeners are people who have this vehicle and have been using it for years, perhaps. And then a portion of our listeners are those who have regular jobs and they pay tax and they have an RSP and whatever they do. What should those non-users of the private corp understand about how it works? Because I think there is some misconceptions for people. And they think, you know, when the people start using the word loopholes or tax cheats or those kinds of things, it kind of misses the point that this was a system designed by the government for certain reasons.
That's exactly right. I mean, these rules have been, and I call them rules, they're not loopholes. These tax rules have been in place for many years, for decades. And people were just using planning that was available to them to try to reduce their tax burden to the extent that they're entitled to. So I think the government, in my opinion, has not done a service to Canadians when they're calling them tax cheats or that they're taking advantage of loopholes, when really all they're doing is using the rules as currently in place. But for people that are listening that haven't done this before, I mean, basically it's running a private business and you build up excess cash in that business. It's money that you don't need to fund your day-to-day bills and lifestyle. So you leave it inside the corporation. You invest it just like anybody else would inside an RRSP. And that investment grows over time and it stays inside the corporation. In general, Bruce, the corporate rates are lower than the personal rates, but it's not a permanent savings of tax. And I think that's what is being missed by a lot of people. If and when the shareholder pulls that money out, they're going to pay the personal tax at that time. So it's a deferral of the personal tax, but it's not a permanent savings. So you pay a lower rate of tax up front, but then you pay the higher rate of tax at the end when you pull the money out. And I think that's being missed as well by some of the analysis, and that this is not a permanent reduction in the tax paid by these people. They're just using the rules as currently in place, and they'll pay the personal tax when they pull the money out in the future.
In that way, is it similar to an RRSP?
Very similar.
Yeah. Well,
with an RRSP, again, you contribute the money today, it builds up over time, and as it's building up, you don't pay that personal tax until such time as you withdraw it. It would be very similar to that. That's actually a good analogy, Bruce.
You're welcome. That's about all I know about taxes, but there you go. You can use that. Dave, thank you for your time. You clearly know a lot about taxes. We appreciate it.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
Dave Walsh is the tax service line leader for BDO Canada. He joined us from Ottawa, Ontario. Time now for the Moolala questionnaire. For those of you who haven't heard it before, it is a series of questions about money, a little bit about life. Our guest, Lamora Markman, real estate expert. Lamora, the first thing that comes to your mind. Are you ready?
Ready.
You sweating a little bit?
A little bit. I don't know where I'm with it.
I know. The first one is,
you may
have even thought about this one before.
On
how would you describe your money?
SiriusXM 167.
Oh, freaking fabulous.
Freaking fabulous. I have never heard that answer before.
No, I would say financially fabulous. That would be the answer.
And what does that mean?
It means making a series of right decisions, working towards abundance, feeling great about money, and feeling like there's tons to go around for everybody.
And is that an enlightened, transformed view of money, or 'twas ever thus? You always felt that way.
I think it's been an evolution, definitely, yeah, over time. I think I've always been fascinated with how money works and figuring out little loopholes and how to invest in real estate, how to make more. Has really made it feel more fabulous.
Who is the number one money mentor that you would credit your fabulous personality to?
Probably my dad. I think the biggest thing is he taught me the value of a dollar very early on. And, you know, growing up, there was like the debt was like a bad word. It was unfathomable. So I have a very solid and grounded foundation on money. And that allowed me through my research, exploration and curiosity to really build on that.
What is one money topic you could talk about, write about, engage with in conversation about every single day without getting tired of it?
Real estate.
Real estate. I know you mean real estate. Have you always loved real estate?
No, I've actually only been like on the real estate train for about 5-6 years. First, I was reading everything that I could possibly read. And then I found myself in one of those cliche 3-day seminars that we all get flyers for all the time. And I sat in the front row with my jaw on the ground for 3 days being like, holy crap. Like, I've just worked in the banking industry for 10 years. How has nobody ever taught me about this? And I just, from then in, I jumped both feet in and have been trying to be a sponge and learn everything I could possibly learn about real estate.
What is one topic you wish you never, ever ever, ever had to write about or talk about when it comes to money ever again?
Stocks.
Stocks. You're just not a stock market person.
I'm just not. I like the idea that I can see the property and it's tangible and I understand it. I've actually taken quite a few classes on stocks. There's one beginner one in particular I've taken three times. It just doesn't stick in my head.
It's just not your thing.
No.
What is one of your guiltiest spending pleasures?
The spa.
The spa. Oh, okay. Do you have a particular one, like somewhere in the world that you aspire to go to that you haven't been to yet?
Gosh, I'm sure there's tons of really fancy, expensive ones I haven't been to around
the world.
Okay,
have you been to one that you love?
There's quite a few that I love in the city of
Pick
Toronto.
Pick one.
Elmwood Spa is probably my most regular.
Elmwood Spa is your classic thing.
Oh yeah, one of them.
When do you plan to retire and what will you do?
Well, I've already left my corporate job with real estate funding my life. So I don't think that the word retirement is ever really going to apply to me the same way. I'm probably always going to be chasing my passions.
What is the number one downside to having income properties? Can you plumb a toilet?
No.
No,
I cannot.
As you were looking at getting into real estate, did you think, ooh, I've done so much work on learning about stocks. I've done so much work about real estate. I should really look at becoming handier with, you know.
Well, I would like to be handier. My dad's actually super handy, but that's why in a lot of my real estate strategies, I don't manage properties the same way that are typical. So I do a lot of like hard money lending, RSP mortgages. I know this sounds like a lot of jargon, but strategies where I'm not necessarily the only person who's holding the house with tenants. They're usually a bit more creative strategies that stop me from needing to do all that toilet work.
If you landed a huge financial windfall, and I'm saying huge is $25 million, what would you do with it?
Commercial real estate all the way.
Commercial real estate.
Yes.
Why commercial versus residential?
I would love to own like a big mall, a strip mall. That's like on
malls are dead. Everything buys everything. Everybody buys everything online.
Yeah, but
how many Subway franchises do we need?
People still go to Starbucks. People still need banks. People still need Shoppers Drug Marts. People will still need to buy from commercial stores.
If you could snap your fingers and change one financial behavior in society at large, what would it be? I'm doing the snap for you.
Get into debt for no reason.
Getting into debt for no reason.
Yeah, you know, like just to shop, to have a better outfit, to keep up with the Joneses, you know, spending without really needing to spend that money. I think that would make things so much easier.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
You clearly need to go back to the spa because that's your that's your happy place. Head on your way.
I'll have to put a spa in my strip mall.
You should. Perfect. That is our program for today. Thank you very much for joining us. To listen to past episodes, they are archived both on iTunes and over on moolala.ca. You can click on full podcasts, versions of the radio show. You can also pick on just specific segments that you want to listen to. Please send us your questions, your comments, your spa recommendations to ask@moolala.ca. @BruceSelry is where you can find me on Twitter. Facebook is Bruce Selry Moolala. Thank you very much for listening and have a great day.